Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you pay, but I got to put you down.
Everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, The Fight City, Hannibal Boxing, a couple other places, and today we're talking some boxing history. In just a moment, my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler, author and filmmaker, is going to be joining us, and we're talking about some Tommy Morrison today. I think that's probably a topic that's going to interest a lot of people. I don't mean to dismiss him, of course, by calling a human being a topic. The guy was, by many accounts, a good dude who was very troubled, and he had a very kind of, I guess I'll just say interesting and intriguing life. Passed away in 2013, so 5 years ago now, and basically we're just going on today to remember his life and times and his boxing career. It definitely happened during a time that I think Bryn and I like to reminisce about, the late 80s and early 90s, partially because that's just our age. It lends to it being very interesting. Anybody who's, you know, between about 30 and 40, I think, is going to be intrigued by that time period in boxing, or at the very least able to remember a lot of it firsthand, you know, whether it was having seen the fights live or watched them live on television, or even just kind of hearing the names at the time and hearing the results of fights and stuff like that. And of course, if nothing else, you've seen that absolutely horrific knockout of Ray Mercer taking out Tommy Morrison on The Great White Hype. That was featured on there. If nothing else, maybe you've seen it on there. But nonetheless, you know, it's just a very ultimately tragic figure, unfortunately. Just another one in boxing. But let's kick it off. Bryn, what's up, man?
Tommy Morrison, the Duke.
Or, hey, yo, Tommy Gunn.
That was pretty good, Patrick.
You know, it's a talent that I have that I don't really unleash very often, just because, like, I don't know. I just don't like to, but I do impersonations and shit like that all the time, and it's kind of sickening.
Well, you're definitely in the vocal range of Stallone. You just don't have – you weren't torn from your mother with forceps to deform your speech patterns.
Right. And my face is, for the most part, symmetrical. And all the muscles in my face work. So that in itself is kind of tragic, but good old Sly. Sly's done a lot for the sport of boxing, man.
I mean, he cemented Tommy the Machine Gun. And I mean, his career just flew after that film.
It really did, you know, and I have to say, I think that this is just a time period that I think that you and I really like reminiscing about, just because of the age, you know, just because of our age. Like, this is a time period that we can, for the most part, remember, even if it weren't like, I'm not going to lie, I wasn't like a massive hardcore boxing fan when I was in my preteens. It wasn't really until I was, you know, well into my teens that I got really into boxing, like maybe like 16, 17, 18. But even so, I still remember. I definitely remember seeing the results of fights. I remember hearing about certain fighters. I knew that Tommy Morrison was a real fighter, you know, because I liked the Rocky movies. Like, you know, even if you weren't into boxing, you probably liked a lot of the fucking Rocky movies. And I knew that he was a real fighter and all that type of stuff. So it's just a time period that I think is, you know, it's some fond memories, and it's good to remember that kind of stuff for us, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was 11 when the film came out in 1990. I think it's the shittiest Rocky of them all, or either that or the one with Antonio Tarver was pretty god-awful, too. But to your point, I mean, Rocky I think, played a huge role in launching Hulk Hogan into the stratosphere of not just sports, but, I mean, the culture. Hogan sort of entered the – Hulk Hogan at his peak was the number one requested celebrity by the Make-A-Wish Foundation, by dying kids, more than Michael Jackson, more than Mickey Mouse, more than any other figure in the culture. Hulk Hogan was the one who was going to come to make to brighten their day, which I think is extraordinary. And somebody who was instrumental in assisting that kind of trajectory was Sylvester Stallone with Thunder Lips in Rocky III. So
no question,
I think you're absolutely right. Blurring the lines with who is this like big handsome guy, big blonde handsome guy who I think completely tells this apocryphal story that he's related to fucking John Wayne. What a load of steaming horseshit that story was. But, you know, he's an active heavyweight, big, strong guy, and he basically is living what he's doing in this film, knocking everybody out. Like, it was clearly – and he was given the role of Mike Tyson, replete with, like, a phony ersatz Don King in the story too. So Stallone was clearly just telling the Mike Tyson story, casting himself as Customato, which is an interesting choice. But it was like really engaging, all of the blurring the lines of fact and fiction. The film itself just turned out to be just so terrible. But yeah, I was interested in on a pop culture level at that time. And same as you, I wasn't really into boxing itself. I was much more into Stallone's weird place in the culture and my childhood, you know, with all him and Schwarzenegger and all that.
Needless to say, there is, I'm not trying to make everything about race, but needless to say, there's an element of, and it still exists now, but in the late 80s and early 90s, this is like, you know, we have a successful white heavyweight, a young white heavyweight who is country, who is, you know, I don't know, I'm trying to think of some fucking stupid ass coined phrase here, like red blooded American or, you know, some shit like that. And,
except the fact it turns out he's actually half Native American, not 1/2000th like Elizabeth Warren, who I like, but the Indian thing is a bad look. But he was half Native American. I didn't know that about Morrison. Did you?
I remember hearing stuff about, because when right around the same time, like with Joe Hip, and like there were a number of other fighters who were like Native American coming up. And I remember hearing stuff about that, but no, I didn't really know that. It makes sense, though. Because there are per capita are more Native Americans in like the Great Plains and in the Southwest than anywhere else in the U.S. But I mean, ultimately, even just the perception, though, obviously, was that there's a young white heavyweight who hits hard, you know, seems to be tough, is successful, knocking people out, getting attention, and on some level, even if it's just subconscious or unconscious or whatever, that's valuable to white America and to the boxing establishment, or at least the perception of it is valuable. And obviously it's more often than not what winds up happening. But still though, him coming up, that lent to a lot of the popularity, a marketable young, you know, white dude.
Well, and he was just, I think he proves your point entirely in that Jerry Cooney, Larry Holmes was, I think, the most lucrative fight at that time in the history of boxing, according to some like major metrics. So strictly because Jerry Cooney was the great white hope, like, you know, he'd knocked out a couple big names in Norton and I think Ron Lyle he knocked out as well. But other than that, it was just a big, strong white guy with a tremendous left hook, which is like, version 2.0 is Tommy Morrison. Tremendous left hook, roided to the gills, entering tough man competitions at the age of 13 where he's fighting grown men. And, I mean, at least according to records that he's produced, won almost everything, and won almost everything, knocking everybody out. So, he's as red-blooded American, great white hope heavyweight as you could ever, like just a wet dream of that manifesting, and looking pretty good as a pro. I mean, there's not a lot of guys who began in the tough man competitions who were worth anything in the pros, and I don't think Tommy was a particularly good boxer, but he was a very dangerous, tremendously dangerous puncher. There's a number of really impressive heavyweights that he fought who said Tommy was the hardest they'd ever been hit. I think that includes Ray Mercer. I think Foreman said that Morrison was one of the most powerful punchers he ever faced. So, yeah, he's an interesting figure in the game. And I think and was one fight away from making an $8 million payday before Michael Bent knocked him out, where instead his next fight he took, he made 60 grand. So that's how precipitous a fall it is for a great white hope to fuck up their opportunity, which he was drunk the night before partying before he fought Bent.
Which, another fairly typical story, but I know that he was a really successful amateur. And coming from a history perspective, I know that he was successful in the Kansas City Golden Glove scene. And historically, the Kansas City Golden Gloves is not like if you were to say that to, I guess, your average boxing person now, they'd be like, the what city? They'd be like, what does that mean? What is that even worth? Who gives a shit about Kansas City? Well, Kansas City actually was one of the premier spots for the Golden Gloves across the U.S. in years past. It was New York, obviously, Chicago, Kansas City. What else was there? Obviously, Philadelphia. There were a couple spots among the Great Lakes. They're actually the Twin Cities had a massive amateur boxing program until, kind of recent years. And my whole point is that he was very successful in an amateur scene that was worthwhile. It wasn't like he was just some, Midwestern punk. He had fought a number of nationally competitive fighters as an amateur and had done pretty well. Now, the thing about amateur records, of course, and this is just kind of as an aside because I'm a rambling son of a bitch, but basically, if you're looking at somebody's amateur record, 99% of the time, that's what somebody's telling you their amateur record is. There's almost 0% verifiable, unless there's video or unless it's something that was a national competition that someone was really keeping records of. Beyond that, it's all just what people are reporting. So he said that he had over 200 amateur wins and then 20 something losses or some shit like that. And so that's just what he said. Who knows what it actually was, but the point was he was pretty successful as an amateur. And that translated into some pretty early pro success when you couple that with, the marketability and his success in the frickin' movies when he's only a pro for a year, year and a half.
He's 20 when it's, 21 when he's filming that stuff, takes 6 months off his boxing career to go film Rocky, super young. And at the beginning, he puts together a highlight reel where, he looks extraordinary. He's a big, strong guy, built like a linebacker with the assistance of huge amounts of steroids. But, I think you can make a good argument. One of the great left hooks in the history of heavyweight boxing. I don't think he had much else, but he definitely had that. I mean, it was cartoonish what he could do with that left hook. It saved him from pretty much sure losses against the likes of Razor Ruddock later on in his career, just because he could unleash it at any moment. It could always save him. And I think even when Lennox Lewis was just annihilating him, they were going to stop the fight. And he said, I've still got my left hook. He's just one of those kind of guys.
Well, and you had said earlier that you didn't think he was a particularly skilled fighter. And I'm not going to argue that he was Pernell Whitaker or something like that. But, he actually did have a pretty good jab. And at times he had good head movement. But ultimately what kind of doomed him against a number of fighters was his lack of head movement and the fact that he, just kind of stood still looking for power shots and didn't move his legs a whole lot. But I don't think he was necessarily unskilled. You know, like he actually had pretty fast hands and could get going offensively really well and could throw combinations really well. It was just, it was kind of within a pretty narrow spectrum. And if you caught him anywhere on either side of that spectrum, he couldn't handle it.
Yeah, I think maybe I was being a little too harsh, because I agree. I mean, in terms of his skill set, I think he makes Deontay Wilder look like Pernell Whitaker. He definitely was somebody who threw nice combinations. And if you look at how good a fighter he could have been, watch the way that he fought George Foreman, because he fought a very smart tactical fight and executed a game plan in every one of those rounds tactically, and an overarching strategy of how to, like, score. He never had good stamina. A lot of people attribute that to the steroids he was taking. And he just wasn't very disciplined with training. He was never effective in sort of calibrating, being a consistent pressure fighter. You can see him almost in every fight by the third round. His mouth is wide open. Watching him fight Joe Hip, I think he broke both hands and broke his jaw and still found a way out of that fight. But he always looks drained fighting. He just doesn't look – there's a tension to the way he fought. But you're absolutely right. Offensively, he had a really dangerous arsenal of weapons to throw. He wasn't just like a left-hook guy. Those combinations, those body shots, and he had power in both hands. He wasn't really known as a devastating right-handed puncher. But watch him fight Foreman. There's a lot of exchanges where, you know, Foreman is always the boss man when he's fighting, just endlessly coming at you. One of the only people I've ever seen take probably 50 shots from Morrison that knocked out anything that was in front of him previous to Foreman. It's incredible the punishment that Foreman absorbs. But dishes it out too. Morrison takes a lot of shots. For people who say that he had no chin, took a pounding from Foreman. And pretty consistently in that fight, every round of it, he's firing back with big shots and wobbled Foreman, almost dropped him in the second round. So, yeah, I guess I was a little too hard on him with the left hook, but not Lennox Lewis skill set.
Definitely.
You know, not like some of these, you know, but more than he could have been. I think he's a real story. I think what the tragedy is he was in a very exciting era. He was a very exciting fighter in that era and just never was able to sort of live up to that potential. It's a consistent story of one fight away from a Tyson or a Lewis or a Holyfield or a Bo, and he loses to somebody that's just a tune-up fight because he didn't train and he was drinking excessively and endlessly womanizing. I mean, a very tormented guy who came from a terrible home life where there were just flashes of greatness. And I think Foreman in the end was sort of his big moment of that whole career.
And on top of that, it was like, you know, the Foreman win obviously did not come without its, detractors and without its, pretty much his best win or his shining moment definitely did not come without a lot of people calling bullshit, basically, which is just kind of adds to the tragedy of I guess him just being a tragic fight, another tragic fighter in boxing, you know, at the end of the day.
We've been jumping around, but get at what kind of fighter he was supposed to be after four rounds of fighting Ray Mercer, where he's beating the fuck out of Mercer. And then maybe one of the most disgusting knockouts happens to him, you know, to just blow him out of the water and almost kill him. I mean, it's I almost don't want to watch that. It's so grotesque. It's like a slaughterhouse porn video sort of thing of what, when he loses by about six knockout shots in a row when the ropes are keeping him up. But he was handily beating Mercer, I thought. Like, I mean, he was on his way to a very, very impressive career if he was able to keep it together in that fight and win a couple others, but that's not the way it went.
And I think that, he obviously would not be the first fighter to not live up to his potential, especially a white heavyweight. I mean, that's just kind of the way it goes. But, yes, he definitely was probably supposed to have been more in some ways. But I guess when you also consider his home life growing up and where he had come from, and, you know, in a lot of ways, perhaps he actually overachieved. You know, in a lot of ways, he perhaps was never meant to even get that far in the first place. And there's a potential element of, you know, there's a chance that the fact he got that far is what ultimately contributed to his tragedy, to him becoming what he became.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, I think he came from an extraordinarily abusive household, as a lot of these guys do, far too many of these guys do. And he was somebody, you know, there was a tremendous undertow in his personality towards self-destruction, you know, maybe more than an undertow, like a riptide pulling him under all the time. And I think a lot of what kind of drew me to him, I think we all, one of my favorite things that was said about boxing, I think Lampley said it, was that unlike all these other sports, there's somebody your size in boxing, whoever you are and wherever you come from, there's somebody in this game who is kind of your body type or sort of has the abilities you wish you had if you, you know, worked hard to develop them, or your flaws. Like it's you're able to identify with these people in ways you can't really in the other games because they're just superhero sized or whatever. But Tommy had this kind of insecurity about him that was, I don't know, there was something refreshing about him. He never seemed like a professional in a way that other boxers do, where they're inaccessibly professional. There was something about Tommy, even hearing that he's a 13-year-old kid in tough man competitions, where I was like, that's not how you're supposed to do it in this game. That's not Ali or Foreman or Frazier. All them come from tough backgrounds, but they didn't come up in tough man competitions. There's something a little embarrassing about him in a way, you know, with his goofy mullet and like even him being in Rocky, like he's kind of goofy in that film in a way that's very endearing. There was something endearing about him. And even when he was sort of playing the role of like badass and he cuts his hair short and grows this sort of weird wrestling goatee, you know, behind it, you could just see like he was a really sad guy. You could feel it, but there were moments of excitement with what he was doing in the ring that made it extra exciting because his home life, you could just imagine, was miserable. Like some of these, you know, Hulk Hogan comes across to me as an immensely depressing character with just a, you know, unfillable vacuum inside, or Ric Flair, these kind of people that are super fun in the moment, but the rest of the time, God help who's ever around them. Morrison had that in a singular, interesting way, at least for me, and maybe it's just the age of, you know, thinking, is this guy going to be something special? Oh, my God, he is going to be something special. Oh, no, he's absolutely washed up and nothing. And then he finds his way back again. It's a great career trajectory of comebacks and fucked up promise, sort of like a third-rate Tyson in some ways with some of the promise and potential and the upsets and fall-offs and all that. And then maybe one of the more sad, unbelievably sad endings at the end that's just bizarre and surreal. But I'm jumping ahead.
Well, I think one of the things that kind of I guess it doesn't make me feel bad or anything like that, but definitely humanized him a bit. Obviously, the losses themselves that he suffered humanized him. And it's tough to really gauge a whole lot, I guess, from the Ray Mercer loss, because, I mean, the dude got fucking blasted, and what more can you say? You know, almost anybody who takes those shots is going to be going out, and so it's like I can't really blame the guy for that. Sometimes those things just happen. But then you look at like the loss against Lennox Lewis, you look at the loss against Michael Bent, and the way that he took the losses is almost just like he was shocked both times. It wasn't even like he was, you know, necessarily beaten down or anything like that. It was like both times during the stoppages, like he gets stopped by Michael Bent and he's kind of just like doesn't really seem to complain much. And I think that the quote he said after that fight was, "I zigged when I should have zagged." And he kind of brushed it off and was like, "All right, you know, whatever." And then when he had gotten stopped by Lennox Lewis, the way that that stoppage happens, like in the look on his face, for whatever reason, it's just like really just representative of him. And I don't know why this sticks in my mind so much. Maybe it was because it was one of the, like when I first started collecting fights, that was one of the fights that was passed around and in good quality. And so I watched it a number of times, but, and also I was a Lennox Lewis fan, but when he gets stopped by the ref and he gets knocked down the final time, the ref comes up and is, you know, kind of like, you know, telling him, "Nah, that's enough. That's enough." And the look on his face is he kind of just purses his lips and is like, "Yeah, okay. All right." And that was just kind of like him. He didn't really seem to have a lot of pushback when it came to those stoppages. Like, he just kind of accepted it. But then when it came to his personal life, like he, it was only a couple months later. That was in like fall of 95 or something like that. And it was a couple months later that it was announced that he had had tested positive for HIV. And then when he had the news conference that he held, where he had said he was, you know, retiring because he had tested positive for HIV. Of course, a lot of people have to remember that it's not like this was immediately after Magic Johnson had had his press conference, but it was still fresh enough in people's minds because Magic Johnson was such a massive, you know, famous figure, is such a massive famous figure, that, you know, it kind of had that tone to it where people were still shocked and like, holy shit, a major athlete has HIV. And when he announced that during that press conference, he pretty much had said, "I'm retiring because I fucked up and because I messed with too many women and because I drank too much and did too many drugs and messed with too many needles." And he pretty much laid it all out on the table right there. But then in the years that followed, he acted as if like that literally never happened. It just never happened.
Yeah, you're 100. No, I heard somebody, I think it was on Mark Maron's podcast, talking about Robin Williams. And he describes, and I never heard the term before, but describes a certain type of person, which is a charismatic depressive, and how manipulative charismatic depressives are in terms of fill that hole that they have inside of them, and just how unbelievably dishonest they are one moment, while how recklessly disclosive they are the next moment. They'll say things out of the blue that are so personal and heartbreaking one moment, and then gain your trust through that, through this corridor of intimacy, and then just betray you endlessly, and you'll somehow latch on to where they were honest the one time and say, "I bet that's the real him, is that he's really an honest guy," as opposed to the 99% other stuff where they're utterly, incorrigibly dishonest. And, yeah, you're right. Tommy has that. I was rewatching a bunch of his fights in the lead-up to talking to you about him, and it's hard to watch him fight Lewis because he's not a quitter at all. He's a really, really tough guy. He doesn't want to give up.
He kept getting up. Even against Bent, against Lewis. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, because he was getting blasted. And, like, I'm not going to argue, like, he wasn't even getting hit, but he kept getting up.
Yeah, and just for accusations, I think that, you know, you're a white hope and you're a pretty boy, or you don't look like a fighter, you know, whatever, that kind of on the basis of Rocky. You could tell that he was trying extra hard to sort of be somebody else. And even just like the steroid use as excessively as he was doing it, a lot of people in his camp were telling him, "Cut this shit out, man. This is fucking up your career. Like, this is harming you with your stamina. and your ability to develop as a fighter, as much as it's benefiting you with power and size and all that. I mean, one of the things with Morrison that I find particularly intriguing, and I don't mean to be getting way off, and then at the end of his career, he looks like a 90-year-old man. Like, he looks like my grandfather that I used to visit in his early 90s, like shriveled up scrotum-looking face the way like 90-year-olds get. But the man died at 44 years old. It's like, if you look up his mugshot, Google fucking Tommy Morrison's mugshot, you'll be like, okay, well, where's the real one he's talking about? No, that's the real one. The bald guy who looks like he's 90 years old and like a complete meth addict is what Morrison looked like at the end. Like, and he was getting plastic surgery to have chest implants in order to deny that AIDS was ravaging his body or the effects of AIDS was ravaging his body. Like, I just think there was a kind of multitude of dysmorphia with him about who the fuck am I? Because watching like a series of his fights, even at weigh-ins, I'm like, your body looks so different from fight to fight. He has these little arms and this sort of big, like 1980s professional wrestling core, like just weird shit is going on in that body as if he's taking a lot of steroids but doesn't know which ones to take or something. Like, I don't know. Is that something you notice? I was just wondering, like, was he getting a lot of plastic surgery in between fights? Because I haven't seen somebody transform in such odd ways and deny that they're transforming since, like, Mickey Rourke's appearance, which is, like, the ninth wonder of the world, how fucking weird it is.
Well, I mean, I don't want to – look, this is all about our dime store – psychology, you know, psychological analysis here. So we're definitely, neither of us are, you know, PhDs in this shit or anything, but, you know, it's kind of akin to saying something along the lines of all strippers have daddy issues or something like that, where it's like, yeah, I mean, that's like probably kind of like offensive, but it's also probably like mostly true. I mean, and I'm sorry like that. I hope that doesn't like get me some meanie texts or tweets or some shit like that. But nonetheless, I think that, excuse me, a lot of people who are struggling with like who they want to present themselves as. I think that Tommy Morrison probably falls, you know, into that category where it was like, he couldn't, excuse me, he couldn't be honest about like who he was from day to day, even in like interviews. He didn't seem to really want to address that kind of stuff when it came to like, you know, he's got a whole shitload of acne on his chest and on his back and is all of a sudden looking beefed up when before he looked like muscular, like a normal boxer. But now all of a sudden he's looking veiny and vascular and shit like that. And, you know, people are asking about his training regimen, and he's kind of looking at him like nothing ever changed. And they're like, dude, you gained 20 pounds of muscle. Like, where did that come from? And he's like, no, I didn't. What are you talking about? That kind of stuff, that kind of, like, inability to just even admit that we're living in reality. I mean, that's like a psychiatric issue. You know, like, that's not okay for somebody to live in that manner. But the problem is that really seemed to be, well, and sorry to interrupt, but like,
I think
there winds up being a theme with, I mean, fighters in general, but especially a lot of the fighters that you and I have talked about. I think that there's definitely a kind of poetry to it, a sort of, entertainment in retelling and reliving tragedies. And boxing is absolutely just full of them. And it's full of these kinds of characters who, you know, probably already started out with some sort of fucking head issue and then got that shit totally cemented and amplified by all of the hits to the head that they took. And in hindsight, this is super easy to see. In real time, it just kind of seems quirky, and we're able to just play it off as like, you know, boxing's a real bear, and, you know, that boxing, it's so silly. And then we look back and we're like, holy shit, you know, this guy was probably getting, you know, severe fucking CTE this entire time. And if he really did have like 250 amateur fights, who fucking knows? And we're basically seeing it play out in real time, except for there are differences to the pattern based on personalities and blah, 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 so we're unable to recognize it, and it's sad.
Yeah, and I mean, I think to your point, you're right, that all of these guys, what we cheer on, where we're just like, you know, they're brave, they go in there, or we hear this mantra, you know, you need to have no fear. These guys are all afraid, because human beings are afraid to go into combat, where when you get knocked out, nobody wants to look like Tommy Morrison after what like Mercer did to them, you know, because you look goofy to be like drunk on your feet. It's a very vulnerable place to be. If anybody grew up with a parent that was an alcoholic, to see your parent wobbly and slurring their words, it doesn't feel good as a kid to see that kind of thing, to see anybody exposed in that way. And I think it's something similar with fighters. It is very dangerous, not just to be exposed to one person like that, but to the public, to like a public that wants to see somebody get fucked up in a really explosive kind of way, to put yourself in the kind of mindset that's necessary to engage in combat with that, you know, becoming a meme or becoming just like reduced to a punchline. These are sensitive, vulnerable guys, because they've got open wounds from childhood. And I think Morrison, that's what kind of got to me about him, is he was one of those rare, he's like the opposite of Mayweather, where everything's transactional and businesslike, or Sugar Ray Leonard, where every interview about, are you going to fight this guy or fight that guy? It's all a tease. It's all a manipulation. Morrison was, do you want to fight Lennox Lewis? Hell yeah. Like, it was just basic, right? And there was something really refreshing about that with him, is when he was wanted to fight, it was just make the fight happen. I want to fight that guy. And he fought that way. He fought them like, I only really know how to fight one way, which is if I don't knock them out, I'm going to get knocked out. So great, let's do it. And when referees were stopping the fight, he didn't bitch and complain. He didn't come up with a bunch of excuses after. It was like, you know, that's fair. Yeah, I probably can't go on anymore. So fuck, I gave it my best, sort of thing. There's something nice about that. I don't know, that kind, that nature of competitor, but the other side of yeah. it was, you know, where he was going as, you know, like watching that 30 for 30 documentary about him, he was somebody that endlessly wanted to refresh this narrative that I can start over again. You know, I lost to Michael Benn. Oh, I lost to Ray Mercer, lost to Lennox Lewis. I think he only lost 3 times in his career. But all of these things that were fucking up around him, including when HIV derailed his career, he was somebody who needed to, he believed in a very frightening way in this fallacy that I can just start over. And if I just really believe it, everybody else will accept it too. Apparently he was pathologically afraid of ever being alone. And which explains maybe a lot of the womanizing and that kind of thing, alcoholism. But, you know, at a certain point he went so extreme to what his behavior had been before about denying some things and clinging to illusions that he, you know, he just went way out there into fucking L. Ron Hubbard territory about I can teleport and I don't have AIDS and, you know, almost perhaps wanting to infect women that he was with, and actually had one of, I think his first wife said she felt bad that she wasn't infected by him because he was more afraid of going through it alone. I mean, my God, that kind of pathology that was at work. But I don't think Morrison is alone in this sort of mentality, because what we cheer on with Muhammad Ali taking on impossible challenges, when he doesn't stop coming back, we're kind of like, what's wrong with you? Like, why can't you just come back for the 10-1, you're an underdog fights that you win, instead of fighting Larry Holmes or Trevor Burbick, or showing us that this isn't really about your virtues of character. It's that you're addicted to this and you can't let go, and you don't care how this damages your family or, you know, these people who care about you. And that's a lot of these fighters, is to get this good, you have to be the most narcissistic, selfish, single-minded kind of person. And it's really exciting what that can produce. But in the rest of your life, you're a fucking psychiatric conference worth of material that you probably won't ever be able to process.
It's funny because a lot of the time in boxing, you know, there are certain expectations and certain stereotypes and stuff like that. It often amuses me when after a fight, or after, like, let's say a close decision, like, or a split decision or something like that, sometimes not even a close decision, and they interview the loser, and the loser says, "Man, I won that fight." And people are like, "How can you say that? Oh my God, I can't believe
right.
it." And I think, dude, this is a fucking world-class athlete, okay? You don't get that far in life thinking you're a loser all the time. You get that far in life believing you're always going to win. And you have that mindset you can't just turn off, especially not after a fight you just lost, that you weren't expecting to lose, and that, you know, you're heated and you're emotional and stuff like that. And it's amusing to me to hear people say, like, that they're surprised that a fighter would claim that they're better than everybody. How could so-and-so say they're the best fighter ever? What were you expecting them to say? If I really thought about it all time, I'm probably, like, top, like, 950. What were you expecting them to really rank themselves at, like, 721 all time? Of course not. Like, this is a fucking fighter, dude. This is what they are. And so it's kind of, the point is that you expect that kind of mindset from a fighter, or at least you should. A lot of people don't, and that's the stupid part, but you should, because that's what a fighter is. But to hear somebody like Tommy Morrison, on the other hand, who's, you know, you don't really hear that kind of sort of refreshing honesty. But some people also don't take it as refreshing honesty. You know, they take it as weakness. They take it as that's somebody capitulating when they don't necessarily have to or need to. And I mean, I guess I could see that. And looking back, though, kind of to tie it to what I was saying earlier about, you know, the, in my opinion, likelihood that there was severe head trauma involved here and a lot of the foibles and the misadventures and stuff like that of Tommy Morrison, you know, it winds up looking kind of funky and a little bit different in hindsight. It winds up looking more like this dude just, he probably needed help, and he probably should have stopped fighting, you know, a lot longer than he actually did, or a lot earlier than he actually did. And, you know, it's unfortunate that it wound up the way that it did, and he wound up the way that he did. I can't remember a ton about, I actually did not see that 30 for 30 about Tommy Morrison, but there were a couple of other, like, I want to say it was like Fox Sports did one of the, like, Behind the Glory or Beyond the Glory, whatever they're called. I want to say they did one on Tommy Morrison, because some network did a kind of little special on Tommy Morrison several years ago. So I don't remember 100% about, like, the details of, you know, surrounding his, I don't want to be sensationalistic here, but his descent into madness, basically. But I do remember when he was more or less on the comeback trail in, like, the 2000s, the guy looked like, he pretty much looked like the vast majority of, like, hair metal and glam rock people from the 1980s and 90s look now. That's, like, exactly what he looked like, but, like, 10 years ago. And, you know, he was wearing, like, eye makeup for some weird reason. I don't know why he was wearing, like, eyeliner a lot of the time. Maybe, I guess, to try to wear makeup and take away some of the wrinkles or something. But then he was, you know, he also had gotten these really grotesque, fucking strange pec implants. Like, homeboy, what's his name, Kawagi, the Mexican dude who was fighting not too long ago. And I mean, just like, and I think he also had gotten like bicep implants or something, but he just looked so, I mean, like it didn't look human, like not right. And I think that that was, it should have been apparent at that point that like, dude, somebody get this guy some help, like ASAP.
Yeah. I mean, I never met Tommy Morrison or saw him fight live, but like watching the documentary, it reminded me not long ago, I did an interview with Mickey Rourke, and it was easily the most surreal interview I've ever done in my life. And I wouldn't even had to have spoken with Mickey Rourke, just watching him arrive and sitting across from him. And like, he starts lighting up a cigarette and is like, "Hey, everybody here, everybody in the room, don't fucking take a picture of me smoking. I'm not pushing that I still smoke," and that sort of thing. With the most deformed face, he looked like a 90-year-old woman with extensive plastic surgery. He like was wearing slippers and stepped out of some SUV wearing a bandana that looked like he stole it from Axl Rose's closet, and still claiming that why his face is so fucked up is a result of his boxing career. I mean, the guy was, he still thinks, I think, I'm totally convinced that Mickey Rourke believes his significance in this world is a result of his boxing career rather than how good an actor he was. That's how, like, utterly delusional he was. This is a guy who fought, like, 5 years ago at the age of 65 in a fixed fight.
Yeah, that was I remember watching that live. I mean, I'm not super proud to admit that I watched it live and went out of my way to watch it live, but I did. And I remember watching that and just thinking, holy shit. Like, this is literally when you scrape the bottom of the barrel, but there's still a little bit of grime left on the barrel. That's what that was.
Well, and if you watch the 30 for 30, what Morrison looks like post-boxing, as you know, he's ravaged by the effects of AIDS because he took like antiviral medication very briefly and then just threw it all away. And I guess his theory was, if I just load up on a cocktail of steroids, it will somehow fix this. You know, he's just the level of denial. And some of these guys, I mean, Michael Jackson taking Prohypnol, I think I'm saying it right, but, you know, like industrial grade
propofol.
Surgical.
We use it all the
level.
Time in the veterinary field, yeah.
And he's using it to take a nap.
Yeah, nah. Like, it's definitely not for that.
Like, there's nothing more powerful to put you under to be operated on.
Yeah, it's we use it all the time in the veterinary field, and it's literally like, you know, it's, you give it tiny doses at a time, and that's like as a pre-anesthetic, basically. It's to put something like to sleep. But as they found out, unfortunately, with Michael Jackson, you know, tragically, it causes respiratory depression, which means that you stop breathing. And then, you know, and it can also cause apnea, which means just stopping breathing altogether. The point is that, like, you know, people using these kinds of drugs is like, and, you know, just kind of willy-nillying it is no fucking good. And that's a sort of issue in and of itself. And, you know, I'm not entirely sure how Tommy Morrison got in his head that AIDS is a conspiracy and that he didn't have it and never had it and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, you can obviously see that he was almost like a stereotypical withering away, you know, kind of like AIDS patient, like untreated AIDS patient. And man, that's a pretty nasty way to die.
No, I mean, it's really fucked up because you watch him where boxing is going to be his salvation. Whoops, that doesn't work out. So then it's like, who the fuck am I after boxing? Who am I as a washed up, you know, multi-million-dollar heavyweight? And then all of a sudden the HIV thing does this incredible press conference where he's brutally honest, then goes in denial about it, still sleeping with all the women he's involved with unprotected, which is, if I'm not mistaken, like a fucking crime. Like, really, really scary behavior.
And yeah.
Then, you know, and openly doing it. Like, I'm just willing to, you know, hand a death sentence to people that he's sleeping with, and justifying it by saying, oh, no, I never had it in the first place. It's a conspiracy. Becomes some kind of born-again Christian, so looking for the church to save him and do that whole thing. But it's just like all these ideologies that he has about sort of being reborn and suddenly realizing my potential. It's like it just happens again and again and again and again. It just never works. It just gets worse and worse and worse as the walls close in with there's no more boxing for you. Your health is falling apart. You know, your whole social fabric is all fucked up. You know, it's just a really, you know, and toward the end, he was with a woman, the 30 for 30 shows this, who was supporting him in his delusions. You never had AIDS. And toward the end of his life, where he's on respirators and that kind of thing, even though he'd been very vocal that he did not want to stay alive that way, this woman kept shifting him from hospital to hospital to hospital, keeping him alive on respirators. And it was just brutal, brutal ending. And there are photographs of him at the end that are even worse than that mugshot of him where he looks like a 9-year-old shriveled scrotum. I mean, it's devastating what happened to that guy. And I don't even think we really know a lot of the details.
Well, and that's just another piece of the, you know, really sad puzzle, is that not only did Tommy Morrison kind of just atrophy into this, you know, conspiracy theorist, fucking weird religious fundamentalist dude, and who just was probably harboring a series of psychiatric issues. Not only was that the case, but he had somebody who was believing his bullshit, or perhaps using him in order to perpetuate the bullshit. Who knows?
Yeah.
And he had somebody able-bodied, totally willing to go along with it and even take it further. And that's really criminal. That's pretty nasty. So I don't know. Needless to say, it's, yeah, from start to finish, I'm not entirely sure if Tommy Morrison's ending, you know, if the end of his story could have gone any different.
Well, and what I wanted to mention to you and just get your sense of it is, as I watched his whole life, the ups and downs and the personal life stuff, I was like, there's some correlation between this and Arturo Gatti that's kind of interesting. Super exciting, not like Hall of Fame caliber fighter. I know Arturo Gatti's in the Hall of Fame, but he's not really in it for his achievements as a fighter. I guess the style that he fought or whatever. God, I mean, this is going to degenerate into like a semantic argument of how do you get into the Hall of Fame. But what I mean is
Bryn, I believe it's called the Hall of Fame. Fame.
Yes, it is. Well, and I, as we've discussed, I love Arturo Gatti. I'm not trying to shit on his legacy. Because I loved Arturo Gatti, once I got into talking to people who knew him, not a very nice person outside of the ring.
Hey, you know what he did for Atlantic City? Fuck out of here.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I love his career, but I mean, I don't think I would want to have been Arturo Gatti's little brother and sort of gone along on that ride, at least where it ended up. And there's something about Morrison that sort of feels similar, like big excitement, made some pretty good money. I mean, missed a lot more money, but then just this, I mean, my God, behind the scenes with Tommy Morrison, it seems almost, I don't know if I think of the professional wrestling world as being a lot more depressing and fucked up than the boxing world. Probably is, but I kind of relate to Tommy Morrison's behind the scenes story more to like a pro wrestler than I do even a pro boxer. And pro boxers are pretty bad, but they're not up there with wrestlers historically.
I mean, I think that it's probably like, it's not even so much my opinion or what I think. You can really just look directly at the evidence, but it's like some really massively high percentage of known wrestlers above a certain level are like dead by age 45 or absolutely wasted physically to the point where they walk with a cane from age like 45 forward. That's sad as shit. I mean, it's kind of like, would you rather be eaten by a shark or eaten by a barracuda? Who knows? They're both bad. But needless to say, in professional wrestling, the percentage might just be higher.
Yeah, but they did that to themselves in support of Vince McMahon becoming a multi-billionaire. So, I mean, it's almost un-American what you're saying, as if they were exploited in some fashion by this extraordinary figure.
Well, and ultimately that's what boxing is too. You know, the money is not going to the vast majority of the fighters. It's going to the promoters and managers and handlers and advisors and stuff like that. You know, that's how it's always been since, you know, time immemorial, or at least since, you know, those things existed in boxing on a grander scale. You know, for a long time it was pretty much just fighters taking care of themselves, and maybe they had a manager. Maybe they had a trainer, and that was it. But now it's those kinds of figures obviously dominate the sport financially. And, you know, that's probably the reason why there are no actual figures or studies you can pull up about this, because why would anybody submit to that and realize that you're taking 95% of the fucking money?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, I find it funny to see interviews with Dana White right now. As soon as you're on the defensive about, like, here's the money I pay fighters compared to what Oscar De La Hoya pays fighters, and they say I don't pay fighters, but I pay them even more than I've contractually, you know, signed them to fight. So, like, I'm really looking after these guys, and there's, like, fucking no transparency in MMA in terms of what these guys are paid, because it looks so awful.
Yeah, that I don't want to get too off boxing, but in the last few weeks especially, I would say largely in the last few years, but especially in the last few weeks, I think that it's been super apparent that the UFC business model is just not good. It's not favorable to fighters. It's dicked around in a lot of fans. You know, the way that they operate is pretty substandard and low level sometimes, and just a massive disregard to the fans. And holy shit, the fact that people at the top in the UFC are taking as much money as they are, and the actual fighters, the talent, the people that this is based around are taking as little as they are and locked into contracts with various, you know, advertising entities and brands and stuff like that, is just, that's, jeez, man, it's nasty.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's no fucking oversight, and he has the monopoly. So, surprise, surprise, if, you know, unions didn't spring up just for fun. They sprung up because of the degree of greed that was out there in the exploitation of these people. So,
right.
I don't know. I mean, I think boxing needs it too. Boxing needs a union or some kind of more oversight than it has. I don't know what it would have done for somebody like Tommy Morrison, like if we could save somebody like that from themselves, because this guy, I mean, it just depends on your philosophical point of view, how accountable is he for it in terms of fucking up his own life, but there was a lot of self-sabotage, but it's also just a system that's not very supportive of these people. And once, you know, to go from the Michael Bent fight, had he won it, he was going to make $8 million. And losing it, he fought for $60,000. I mean, I don't know many industries where there's that kind of fall off, where it's just winner take all. But that's the game. And he fought a fight like that, drunk the night before and didn't train at all. So is it that he just too arrogant, or was it a real push towards self-destruction? I don't know, but a lot of these fighters, you know, Tyson fighting a Buster Douglas, you think this is your profession. You don't want to get in shape when you're fighting somebody 6'4", 230.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really all just depends on, like you said, your kind of philosophical outlook on this kind of stuff. You know, are you a social psychologist who believes it's the social situation that always dictates how you act, or are you somebody who's, you know, all for holding people accountable regardless of the situation? Whatever. But clearly, I think that kind of in regards both to the union comment and Tommy's upbringing and how he wound up and everything, there's probably some sort of balance or combination to this. He had a rough upbringing, if not in terms of having a really bad childhood, but dude, if you're entering fights and tough man competitions in your early teens and you're being pushed into doing it by your father, that's probably not the healthiest of environments, needless to say. And coming into your formative years in that regards is not going to lay a good groundwork or foundation for you to become a very, successful human being later in life. And then the fact that you are receiving blows to the head that are probably damaging something in your brain is going to really just deteriorate the possibility of you being productive later on even further. And, you know, you add the way that he acted and the chemicals and shit like that he put into his body, and you just really have a recipe for fucking disaster, man. And that's really what it comes down to. As far as the union thing, I'm not necessarily pro-union all of the time or anything like that, but the point of unions is to create a balance of power. That's really all it is. And that's why I say I'm not necessarily pro-union. I'm pro-balance of power. I am pro not having all of the power in the fighter's hands, or not having all of the power in the promoter's hands, or et cetera, because, and that's the whole point of having these things, is that one side is, there's a give and take, a push and pull. And boxing and MMA, for that matter, could really use unions. There's been a push in MMA in particular to unionize fighters, but the push back from promoters and the people who actually put on the fights is serious enough that it really seems to have people kind of having second thoughts about it. Or what they classically do when people try to unionize is they will raise pay just enough to kind of make them forget about it for a little while, even though the pay raise is still well below what they should be getting paid. It's just a distraction. And anyway, boxing could use something like that. It could use a pension system. It could use a union. It could use a nationalized or in some other way regulated ranking or championship or whatever system or sanctioning organization. It could use a whole lot of things, but a whole lot of things that they're probably just not going to get because the balance of the power is so shifted in such a way that even getting that started. Hell, they passed the Muhammad Ali Act and all that type of shit, and they've been able to do absolutely zero to enforce it. So, I don't know.
Well, I mean, look at the visibility of Al Haymon completely offering the intention of the Muhammad Ali Act. He is completely a promoter and a manager operating with a conflict of interest for what, like 10 years as like the most prominent force in the sport. And like, where is anybody throwing up flags in his way? So,
And not to mention, even beyond that, even getting beyond, like, you know, the fact that it's even boxing related, period, you're getting into violating antitrust laws and doing it fairly, like, obviously, like, not even really hiding it or anything like that, but violating antitrust laws that are meant to discourage monopolies. And, you know, you literally see, like, three promoters with 98% of the big-time talent in the sport and almost zero motivation to match them against one another. It's, you know, this is not, we're not saying anything radical or anything like that. This is just what's happening in the sport. All we're doing is just recognizing it. So it's really, I until something like this type of, like, you know, unions and all these kinds of things happen, until somebody is actually looking out for the well-being of these fighters and not just, you know, pretending to or taking money as they're saying they're doing it, I'm not sure that any of that would change. But as a number of people have also said, and as I've echoed many times over the years, do you want safe boxing or do you want boxing?
No, that's all true. I mean, I'm not speaking to that issue. I mean, if you guys are, you know, if you're a fucking coal miner and that's how you want to make a living, like, I think people have any kind of blue collar work is part and parcel with signing up for it, is you're basically giving up your body. So I think boxing falls in line with that. You know, I don't want people, smoking is going to kill one out of two people. So, like, should we have a right to do things that are unhealthy? Like, isn't that part of freedom, you know, to live in a free society? Like, yeah, it is. It is. Like, otherwise, like, move to fucking Singapore. Or, like, you know, you spit, you're committing a crime that's going to be enforced. So I'm okay with that. There's just so many elements of it that are archaic. And when the cautionary tale of boxing is the rule rather than the exception, I think you have to look at a kind of broader culpability for why it's happening, that it's systemic rather than, oh, this fucking irresponsible, financially illiterate athlete. Yeah, they are that in many instances, but it's a system that, you know, enormously encourages it. And you could create a lot of safeguards there that I think would improve the conditions and I think give the sport a much better reputation. Like, legitimate reputation, not just, like, sanitizing the PR of it, but actually, like, just improving it so that, you know, I remember as a kid seeing some of the older fighters in person. I remember seeing Joe Frazier came to Vancouver when I was a teenager. And, like, I don't know. I just thought, oh, my God, like, this guy didn't lose very many fights, and he can't talk properly. And he just looks so fragile. What the fuck is going on? Like, I think a lot of people have that with boxing, is like casual fans only see the young guys in their prime, or like there's a certain kind of tourism into it where it's different for the boxing heads to see these guys age, to see them get washed up, to see them come back again and again and again.
Yeah.
That's not something that casual fans witness with anything close to the regularity that, like, the hardcore fans see and understand, like, that none of these guys can escape the game most of the time.
Well, I say this pretty frequently because I think that it bears repeating, but it causes people cognitive dissonance. It makes them have to think tough thoughts about what they're supporting, paying for, watching happen before their eyes. You know, and they don't want to do that. They don't want to confront that because it's difficult and because there is no answer beyond just not fucking doing it. And I mean, I'm one of them, so it's not like I'm trying to speak from a moral pedestal and say, look at all you guys making this decision. I do too. But the point is that, you know, that's why these conversations are here, and that's also why many avoid them.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know how many of these questions Morrison's career brings up, but it's just it's an interesting career in terms of some pretty high peaks and some really scary places that it went. And I mean, I still wonder before Floyd Mayweather's story is over if we're going to get anything kind of similar, because I wouldn't be surprised. He's got the resume for something as special as Morrison.
Well, I mean, I have to say that I don't. It's not that I want to see Floyd Mayweather like, you know, a deteriorated piece of crap or something like that. So I wouldn't cheer it on.
I'm not cheering it on. I'm just saying,
and
I wouldn't be surprised.
No, sure.
I
wouldn't either. But I mean, I was going to say that I'm happy to see that he seems, at least for now, to be doing very well financially, and seems to be well taken care of in that regard. But he also, to me anyway, seems like a really lonely dude who probably cannot relate to very many human beings, period.
Sure.
And I'm not saying that with any sort of fucking comedy factor at all. I'm saying 100% serious. I think that he is a weird dude who himself had a weird upbringing, you know, a very sad one too. I mean, if you look into Floyd's upbringing, it's fucking sad. There was a lot of tragic shit that happened when he was a kid. And, you know, he also is fairly prodigious as a fighter, grew up being raised as a kind of prodigious fighter and pushed in that regard, kind of in a Tiger Woodsian fashion. And I think that those kinds of people never really learn to socialize with other people or to empathize with other people or what it is to be anything else. And again, dime store psychology here. It's just, I think that there's some truth to it. And when I see Floyd Mayweather's social media posts and shit like that, dude, I honestly think that dude is lonely as fuck. That guy, he doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't do shit. He doesn't, like, do anything except for just, like, basically hang around people who watch him spend his money. That is weird as hell, dude. And, you know, that's great that he's financially secure, but I just can't imagine that there's really much else to his life but that in the years to come. And on top of that, the way that he spends money, I can't imagine he's going to be financially secure for that long. Because he's not going to be able to fight these fucking weird, Japanese kickboxers that people are going to be able to actually, you know, they're going to lose interest with this type of shit eventually. And eventually, physically, he won't be able to put up with it. So what does he do then? I don't know.
No, I mean, it reminds me when you're talking about Floyd, and I agree with you. I remember like doing a deep dive into the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat, and when he really hit as the first like American black artist to really hit while they were alive, I think they interviewed his limo driver and said the most depressing thing I ever saw in my life was Jean-Michel getting into the limousine in a paint splattered Armani suit with a pile of cocaine and them just driving around because he had nowhere to go. There was nobody to see and there was nowhere to go. And there's some element of that, as you say,
yeah,
with Floyd, that it's just pointless. I mean, it's similar. I'm biking around New York. The idea that billionaires name things after themselves is itself a very depressing idea. The whole point of naming something is to, like, name it after somebody else, right? That inspired you or that inspired the culture. But
yeah,
a life of
honoring yourself. You know, imagine that on your gravestone. He died honoring himself his entire life. Cool.
Yeah, like, I just biked by the Koch brothers' apartment on Park Avenue, and
you go
by the Koch Theater or whatever, and it's like, this is who inspired you? Yourself? It's, you know, it's sort of like how I feel about watching Tom Cruise movies. It seems like his sexual orientation, I don't know if it's gay or it's straight, I presume it's masturbating to himself, like in the mirror or something. That's the only thing that apparently turns him on in a sexual way. And I don't know, it's a strange world. So,
well, blame Bobby. That's all I got to say.
I mean, you pretty much have to, and you can feel good about doing it.
Yeah, it's a win-win-win.
I mean...
Oh, jeez.
Well,
sick
no,
puppies.
We needed a weird ending. We needed a weird ending because it is Tommy Morrison we're talking about.
That's true, and he himself had a weird ending. Gotta echo that, you know, poetically. And it's unfortunate that we wind up having to talk about a lot of fighters who were, you know, had a tragic ending. But again, as I said earlier, I think that there's a sort of, you know, just greater entertainment in recounting loss and in recounting sadness and tragedy. It's just, and on top of that, there's just such an abundance of it in boxing. It's easy to pull from. And nonetheless, you know, hopefully this wasn't taken as us trashing Tommy Morrison for an hour and a half or anything like that. But, you know, just kind of just remembering, just, you know, discussing, you know, recounting, et cetera, because that's all we're going to do.
Well, no, and I think the broader point about that is that winners, as Floyd shows, in some ways, the way Andre Ward shows, there's something one note and a little bit flat about it when you compare it to losers. Losing, like, it's that old Tolstoy thing, you know, the homogeneity with happy families versus every unhappy family, it's unique. And there's something about in boxing, I think, more than the other sports, that when these guys go down a road into darkness, you're never telling the same story. I mean, there are some elements that are similar, but Jesus Christ, they reinvent the wheel with what the fuck is that? I mean, I can transport as Tommy. Like, that's where he was at the end. That's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I remember he was starting to get into kind of some, you know, mystical, like, believing in the power of pyramids type of shit, you know, which is, yeah, just kind of on its own level in terms of psychosis. So it's, yeah, that's where we're ending. We're leaving with, you know, believing in the power of crystals.
And L. Ron Hubbard. I've been pro L. Ron Hubbard for a few years now.
Well, just make sure when you're done biking to go get your thetans checked.
I always do. I'll check it up on the old e-meter. But yeah, that's a good spot to end, I think.
Perfect. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining us today. And if you tuned in for this entire time we talked about Tommy Morrison, you're sick and just go away. Just kidding. Don't go away because we want you to listen next time. But thanks again. And we very much appreciate it. If you wouldn't mind, if you're on Twitter, go follow us on Twitter. Follow Bryn at Brynicio, Brynicio. And follow me, Patrick Connor, at Boxing History. And if you want to go on to Facebook and throw a like to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page, that would be cool too. But even cooler would be if you went on iTunes and you threw us a rating on there, wrote a sentence or two in the little rating, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It helps. That's it. Ooh, hello, you still there, Bryn? Or did you crash your bike?
Still there. It cut out for a second. But yeah, thanks everybody for listening.
For sure, man. All right, we'll talk soon.
You got it.
All right, Take it easy, everybody.